Show with Greg Berg is next. Support for The Morning Show comes from the University of Wisconsin-Parkside, offering an online master's degree in healthcare administration. Learn the skills necessary to be a leader and make an impact in the ever-evolving and diverse field of healthcare, in partnership with UW Extension. Details available at uwp.edu. And we welcome you to the Friday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. I'm sorry to say that our scheduled guest for today canceled, and so we need to be into the morning show archives, but we are bringing you two really interesting interviews. And one of them actually is an interview originally recorded and broadcast back in 2008, but it is remarkably timely. It is a book that I think is a very discerning look at some of the ways in which we find ourselves so divided. The interview is with Joe Bajant, the author of Deer Hunting with Jesus. We'll have another interview out of the archives for part two of today's program. By the way, looking ahead to Monday's morning show, I am excited to be speaking with Carthage College Professor of Political Science, Dr. Gerald Mast, who will offer his reflections on the remarkable events of the last several days. The morning show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock. The program is archived on our website, wgtd.org, and is also available as a podcast via Spotify, Google Podcast, Apple Podcast, and all major podcast providers. Be sure you look for The Morning Show with Greg Berg. All right, here's part one of today's program. I'm very excited for the next few minutes to be able to speak with a very, very talented writer by the name of Joe Bajant. You can catch a lot of what he does in an online column, which can be found at www.joebajant.com. I'll spell all that for you at the end of the interview. But he is someone who really knows how to write in compelling fashion about some of the most important issues facing us. And his book, Deer Hunting with Jesus, Dispatches from America's Class War, is a really fascinating look at Joe Bajant's hometown of Winchester, Virginia. And it is the story of Joe Bajant essentially being at odds with many of the people who live there, and for that matter, with a lot of his own family, viewing the world in very, very different ways. And this book is not only about those contrasting world visions, but also maybe a little bit about how one side can communicate with the other and make sense of the other's perspective. At least that's one of the things which I take away from this really entertaining and very thought-provoking book. Again, it's called Deer Hunting with Jesus, Dispatches from America's Class War, published by Crown. And Joe Bajant, we welcome you to The Morning Show.
Well, thank you for having me on.
Tell us a little bit about the circumstances which brought you back to your hometown of Winchester, Virginia.
Well, you know, my family's been here since 1745, so, you know, I have deep roots here. Those of us who are lucky enough to have a hometown, to have a series of connections with place and people and everything, you never really forget it. So I lived on the West Coast and in other places for nearly 30 years. And then, of course, like all Southerners, you come back, somehow you end up coming back around to your roots. So I looked for a job on the East Coast. I worked in magazine publishing as an editor for different kinds of magazines, and moved back here and bought a big old rundown Victorian house. But when I looked around in the old neighborhood I grew up, I was in absolute shock at how much worse off the people were, although often they didn't feel that way. But the fact of the matter was that so many of them had no health care. They had no real financial horizons. They didn't have any job security. Many of them had the houses that they grew up in that their parents owned. They were now renting from landlords. And I finally came to the conclusion that a large disenfranchised group of white working Americans are not even on the radar scope because they don't complain. Bad debt, you know, hard, you know, medically incurred debts and so on were bringing them down in a way that I just couldn't believe what was happening to them.
You know, as you describe this, it occurs to me now, it didn't come to me quite so clearly as I read your book, and now I understand this, I think, even better. The beauty of this scenario, I mean, it's of a very sad picture, but the fact that you returned to a place that you once knew and saw the changes and immediately knew that something had gone wrong, versus if you had never left Winchester, Virginia, it probably would not have struck you in the same sort of way. It would have been sort of a creeping deterioration. Or if you'd simply gone to another place that was unfamiliar to you and tried to chart what was wrong. But the fact that you returned to a place where you had once lived, I mean, what a perfect scenario to sort of gauge the decline of a place and its citizens.
That's a really good observation. I had not thought about what would happen if I would have stayed. I'd probably be working at the Rubbermaid plant or someplace around here like that. I got away from here. I quit school in the 11th grade and went in the Navy. Now, I was restless and just wanted something different. I got a GED in the Navy and then subsequently went to school and became a journalist and then an executive in a magazine publishing company. When I came back, I wasn't prepared for it, and it's just like you say. It's so incremental. It's that old thing of the frog boiling in the water. And I don't think that anybody that didn't leave here, I mean, anybody that stayed here, could see the creepingly, and again, too, these are uncomplaining people, and they believe the whole thing about personal responsibility. So when things went wrong, for instance, a lot of people have very high credit card debt on 2 or 3 credit cards, but the fact of the matter was they had a medical emergency, and so it cost tens of thousands of dollars, so they're under that crushing debt, but they saw it as, oh, my own failure to really handle money right. I felt really sad about that because there's a larger picture there that says, look, you know, people deserve to be healthy. Why does your kid have rotten teeth?
You know? That's part of what, there's really two things that bother you at the root of much of what you see. One is this sort of passivity, this acceptance of this situation, which you find unacceptable. The other thing that also is such a running theme is anti-intellectualism, which at another point in the book you call the rejection of fancy learning. The idea that the more you have been educated out there in the world, the less you can be trusted, or the less valuable your perspective might be. Talk with us a moment about some of the ways in which this anti-intellectualism showed its face to you, and also what you did about that as someone who probably considers himself to be, you know, intellectually pretty alive, trying to interact meaningfully with people who just don't seem interested in that kind of intellectual life.
Well, we were all, and still continue to be in these families, raised with no real intellectual horizons. I mean, the idea of going to college is not mentioned amongst millions of families. It was never mentioned in mine, never even thought of. America's working class predisposition against intellectuals and intellectualism is a long-running thing. It's a long thread in American history. And the experience with it is not always good. For instance, the cream of the crop around here, just like a lot of other places I've spoke to people and publicly and all, the best and the brightest are cherry-picked out of there through scholarships and so on, and they end up there sipping on a latte in Seattle. You know, they never come back. Because I would ask where certain friends are, all and they went off to school and they just never came back. And there's also in the most desperate, I'd say real working poor, a history. If a whole family, if nobody ever got an education, then in the first place it doesn't occur to you as an option. And second, if some of them did and never came back, parents see it as almost a threat, you know, like you lose your child to it. So, you know, it's a very complex thing. But in general, you know, working people in general, they're going to be conservative by nature and not like the new, which is, of course, a life of the mind brings you something new all the time. That's why you practice it. And they tend to be conservative if you don't want to risk what little you've got. So you vote conservatively, you live relatively conservatively compared to the rest of America. But the bad part of it is, the worst kind of poverty is ignorance. And having said that, I'd say that the worst poverty I see is in the white gated suburbs. I mean, they live insulated lives of nothing. My pals down at the beer hall are at least worldly.
You know. So ignorance can show its face in a lot of different ways.
Well, I think there's a class divide. Nobody wants to admit that. Is it liberal, conservative, or is it urban versus rural? Is it educated versus uneducated? Well, it's those three right there. Put them together. And if you stop and think about it, in the first place, only 19% of Americans get a college an education from a really legitimate university. 22% if you count technical and trade schools, in which you'll never open a piece of literature or be exposed, you know, to the humanities. 27% if you want to count everything that's on the back of a matchbook and Christian colleges that teach nothing but biblical creationism. But however you put it, 60 or 70% of Americans that don't go to, 75% that don't get a college education are left without the tools that it takes to function in a textually and with literacy in a society. I don't think much of universities in general. I think they're self-perpetuating pieces of crap that grind out managers for a capitalist system. But having said that, at least you come out with enough literate skills to function, you know. And in the old neighborhood that I write about in there, 2 out of 5 don't have a high school education.
Well, and as you say, for many, many Americans, it is not even a possibility that is seriously considered. And if that's the case, then it's little wonder then that they also go through maybe high school very, very differently, because they don't see that high school education as a springboard to still further learning and still further growth. It's just something you sort of grind your way through until you finish, and then you start working at a job someplace. I mean, it's such an interesting way to look at one's life.
Well, yeah, you know, if you come from a family where my wife, she's from Illinois, and it was just an accepted thing. Everybody went to college. I never knew anybody in my family that did. I barely knew anybody that did, period, when I was a kid. And you know, if that's not a possibility, the other part of it is getting through high school, the way that certain kids will apply themselves is because they've had the model in the home. College is an expectation, and that's a whole different track. That's also a minority track of Americans. Statistically, all the government says 1 out of 4 quit high school. I look around, the number's a lot higher than that, and I could not understand why. If they can't see working class America anyway, they're not going to see what the dropout rate is. Turns out, when high school, if somebody drops out and they show it as transferring, you know what I mean? Like the guy says, I'm quitting school and going to such and such, then the kid transferred, didn't he? you know, and it's never picked up on the other end. And I found out that a lot of people just sort of disappear, and it's as if they transferred out of school on the records.
Hmm. For good.
And the rate is driven higher yet, of course, by immigrants. You know, nothing against immigrants, but, you know, a whole lot of people. I mean, I've lived in Latin American societies, and I live in one now part of the year. And a lot of the emphasis, you know, with the people that come from the rural areas of Latin America, Mexico, Nicaragua, and all that, have the same view of it that poor working whites have, same view of education.
Right. You say at one point that, you know, growing up, and you as a young adult, for instance, you said we could always believe that our kids had a chance for a better life. I certainly achieved a better life than my parents. But you say these days it's harder to believe that. That class divide was then a steep and ugly ditch. Now it is an absolute canyon and growing deeper. What is the most compelling evidence of that?
Of the class divide?
Right. I mean, of the fact that it is even more marked than it once was, and getting more so.
Because the methods by which it perpetuates itself have hardened. The class, say, that goes to an institution of higher learning is more separated than ever. You know, they can't even perceive each other. The thing that shocks me is that so many people, you know, and I'm a liberal. Heck, I'm so far left, I got to send out smoke signals to see the Democratic Party, you know. So I'll say that right now. But the thing is that after a life of living in urban liberal communities and university towns and publishing centers and all that stuff, it was very, very clear to me that they had no idea of the life of the guy that greases their Prius, you know, or laid the sod in their new house or whatever. Absolutely no comprehension of these people or their lives. They were just like fixtures in their lives. And the degree of separation that you could possibly have from something that represents 60 or 65% of the population, it just struck me how here I was doing the same thing. I did the same thing the Democrats did. At first, I ignored the working class in America, and then I forgot they existed. It was very easy to do when I was coming back from France on a plane with my Cuban cigars. It was very easy to do because the experience around you did not integrate these people, and you weren't gonna bump into them unless they were waiting on you hand and foot. Wiping your grandmother's butt in the nursing home, you might run into one.
We're speaking with Joe Bagent. We're talking about his book, Deer Hunting with Jesus, Dispatches from America's Class War. It tells the experience of him returning to his hometown of Winchester, Virginia. Let's talk about this point, because I think this is especially interesting, and I feel like this is one of the most important parts of your book, because I feel like even if someone is not as progressively minded as you are, I mean, even someone who would count themselves more of a conservative or a moderate or whatever, but not where you are on the political spectrum, I think they would still find so much of your discussion really fascinating on the divide that we are talking about. You say, for instance, that, you know, a given person in Winchester, Virginia, who is quite conservative, you say that it's most likely that a given person of that persuasion will not personally know one single registered Democrat. I mean, they won't know a single one, won't have one as a friend, knowingly even have one maybe as a neighbor or an acquaintance, you know, let alone ever engage in any kind of meaningful conversation. And probably, as you're just alluding to, vice versa is true as well. I mean, people not even knowing each other.
True. Well, one of the things is that the Republican Party has great grassroots, meaningful grassroots. The average businessman in a small town is a Republican, unless historically, you know, it's somewhere near Chicago or something, and they've always been Democrats. But, you know, the guy at the Rotary Club, the guy that has the shoe store, or traditionally anyway, in Harry Truman's Main Street America, you know, they were so often, he's not a good example, but they were so often Republicans and believed Republican values, you know, of business and small business and the business of business. Well,
yeah,
I like this quote.
You say Republicans' everyday lives seem naturally woven into the fabric of the community in a way that the everyday lives of the left have not been since the Great Depression.
Yes. See, when they go shopping, you know, it used to be anyway for the big box stores, or they get a loan or whatever, they have face-to-face contact with with the Republican small business and middle-sized business class. They're very likely to see them in some of the places they gather because, I don't know when you'll ever see an urbane liberal Democrat in a VFW listening to Teddy Whip and the Doodoppers play country music. It just doesn't happen. And so they have contact with it, and it rubs off. It also provides explanations for things. Not that anybody sits around talking about politics. Working class people, they don't even think about it until 2 weeks before the election, and the noise gets so loud you can't avoid it. You're thinking about truck payments and your kid's performance on the swim team or whatever they're doing, It's a divide. Hmm. And they call it a culture war. Yeah, if you want to call it that, but that'd be a uniquely liberal thing of describing it. What it is class differences.
Hmm. You say the rightists succeed at forcing their vision of America down our throats because they have committed themselves to organization and communication. I mean, they are right there where ordinary people are. And you say liberals, in contrast, chatter among themselves online or at social gatherings and make little attempt to engage, much less convert, the heathen tribes. That is a really interesting observation. And it would be interesting to know people of that persuasion, what their reaction is to hearing that. I mean, how many of them see themselves in that indictment?
Well, it's interesting. It's all over the place, the reception for the book. It got a good review on Free Republic, that's a website, a very conservative website. And, it's surprising because urban liberals online, a lot of them online, very active. Yeah, they're active online. we're just offended. Others said that's exactly the truth. So the response was all over the place. Some conservatives said it's a great book. It's absolutely accurate. When I go, my Lord, these two are agreeing. Some parts of them are agreeing. I can't say I've had a bunch of hate mail or anything. Most people, they agreed with it. I don't know what to say about that, except to me it indicates there is middle ground. I think there's some degree of compassion out there left in the world. And I think people want to see America be a better country. They just don't want to get off their butts to do it.
One of the things that is intriguing for you on a very personal level is not only getting to know some of these people who are ideologically so different from yourself, but also that you are from a very religious family, in fact, with a brother that is a clergyman. And you describe, I think, in very interesting, compelling fashion, the interesting challenge it has been for you to accept them and for them to accept you, and which to some extent, to maybe a remarkable extent, you managed to do.
Well, I am lucky. I grew up in a family where there was love. It was certainly tough love. The old man would whip your butt with a belt if you did something wrong. It was a tough Calvinist, Scotch-Irish-rooted family and love. But even older, now all of us are in our 50s and I'm 60. We did love one another, and we do love one another. The fact that there is virtually nothing to talk about in this alienated world is the horror. I'll never be a fundamentalist Christian, and he'll never be a secular humanist. But, to call him clergy, you're being kind. For a lot of fundamentalist preachers, I call them stump preachers. They didn't go to it. It goes all the way back to colonial times, and again, the Presbyterian Kirk and the Scots-Irish Calvinism. These people are essentially self-educated, charismatic, self-inspired. So you can't really say clergy. I guess you could, but it just doesn't have that air of formality about it.
Interesting.
So I was really surprised when my brother became a preacher. I was even more shocked when he came out. When he tells me about casting out demons, many little incidents. I think I put a few of them in the book.
Oh, they're very, very interesting. I want to ask you about something else. I would hate to not have the chance to ask you this before our time is up. You say that one of the biggest quandaries in writing this book is that people trust me not to make fools of them. You happen to say this, actually, in this chapter in which you talk about your very religious family. But it seems to me that that is a theme that stretches throughout this book, in all of these different people whom you encountered, trying to be true to them and to who they are and who they are not, and somehow to do so without ridiculing them, even inadvertently. Tell us a bit about how you handled that really interesting challenge.
Well, it wasn't hard. I love them.
You love these people, even...
Yes, I do. They're my people. And it's not in me to ridicule them in that way. Sure, I could make some jokes, being one of them. I could make jokes about us being rednecks and hard-headed and all that, and it's in good nature. I haven't had one working-class person complain about my portrayal of the people in there, even the people portrayed. Not at all. Now, they don't buy the book or read the book because they don't buy and they don't read, you know, but... The tavern owner in the book, I gave them a signed copy, and every now and then they read some of it aloud, and everybody goes, hey, that's old so-and-so, and they laugh, and they go, yep, that's the truth. That's exactly what happens with insurance and things. On the other hand, I've had complaints that said I mocked and ridiculed them from rich people, of all people. I get these calls on the phone, how could you say such things about our town? You know, there's 10 or 12 very wealthy families here that control and own everything. I get calls, you have besmirched the town's leading families. I didn't know we were being led anywhere, but, you know. So it's surprising. The accusations on those occasions that they do come up are from the wealthy people in town that exploit these working people.
Hmm.
I can't believe it. They own the businesses that do the poultry or whatever, and they get on Amazon, and they got like an organized campaign, you know, to... knock off as many stars as they can. This just really surprises me, and it's also kind of indicates the nature of their ability to organize. Or I suppose the paper will come out here with both barrels pretty soon. You know, it's an ultra-conservative, push-to-war, finer families paper. But I had none of the people in there, working-class people, complain. In fact, they were laughing and happy. They had me sign books that they're never going to read, you know.
Interesting.
Well, it indicates a class difference.
Right. Well, and it indicates, too, that at the heart of this book is your love for and concern for what you call the working screwed. I mean, those who are not being given, in your view, a fair shake at all. And certainly you hope for better days for all of them. And not just the ones who live in your hometown of Winchester, Virginia.
Well, my hometown is just, it's very typical. Springfield, Oregon, right next to Eugene. Eugene's a liberal bastion and a super, you know, university town. Next to it is Springfield, Oregon, entirely inhabited by the kind of people in this book. I could show you Maine, Indiana, Illinois, Texas, Iowa. They're everywhere, and we recognize one another. I know what joint to walk into, and I can find something to talk to people about because they're all the same and they got the same problems, you know. So I focused on one quadrant of my hometown because it was just so perfect, and also I understood it thoroughly. You can't talk about the roots of something that happens in Moline, Illinois, which is exactly the same kind of thing, a manufactured town, without I could look at these people, and I knew their childhood, and I knew their grandparents. Knew the house that we played in their yard, and so there was a certain ghostly quality to it. I mean, I was constantly looking at the past and then looking at the person. My Lord, they're all 60 and fat and burnt out too. So it gave it a resonance because I understood both the community and the people.
Hmm. How is it that you are not exactly that? I mean, you said these are your people, and yet obviously in some very important ways you are not one of them. How did it happen that you are not?
Well, I get asked that a lot, and I don't know. I can think of the things that made it happen differently. I grew up up till I was 12 or 13, I guess it was, whatever you're in when you're in the fifth grade. And I played in the woods a lot by myself on a really lonely farm up there my grandparents had. It was a wonderful place, though. They'd kill a dozen hogs a year, and people tromp in from the snow from hunting. And it was a wonderful way. But during the days, you were alone playing in the woods, and so you got to develop a little bit of an interior life, you know, just because I don't think kids have that today. They've got the distractions, the games and everything. But an interior life, it's almost, it's of the mind, but it also could be called moral or spiritual. You had a lot of time to think. Then when I moved into town, I had more opportunities, but also more. But I think that I came with a certain degree of reflection. I think it's what makes me write, and a lot of people write. And then, lo and behold, there was the town library. Huge, wonderful old Beaux-Arts place with thousands and thousands of books. Well, in my family, despite they may not have been great readers, and they might have been uneducated, but you know, my mother and dad would lay around on the bed in the evening and read ranch romances and all the pulp novels and stuff. I mean, it was really crap by any standard. But the act of watching them do it. And then my mother, who deserved a heck of a lot better out of life than she got. She grew up picking cotton in North Carolina. Tough life, alcoholic parents, so on. Would subscribe to the Reader's Digest. And then she subscribed to the Reader's Digest Condensed Book Club. Well, all that time up there in the country, I was laying around reading them. Oh, my Lord, I just thought this dazzling world of Africa and the mystery of urban people getting off and on of trains going nowhere. So by the time I moved to town, I moved into a classist society in which the redneck kid with the bib overalls from the country got immediately put in the slow learner. And then the other thing was that library, you know. And so by the time I was 16, I'd read Genet and all these people. It was just like this huge banquet after school and all through the weekends and unlimited books. And that had a lot to do with it. It had a heck of a lot to do with it. And I still hunted and fished and had a trap line in the morning to pay for school books and stuff. So it was a world of both of them mixed and traveling along side by side. I had an intellectual life that was budding, actually, it was doing just great, you know, compared to what possibilities are today for a kid in school. And I had some teachers that encouraged it. They put me, it was odd, they put me in the industrial arts track, spend your life in shop. Because, hey, this kid's been living over in West Virginia, he can't have two brain cells. But at the same time, there were some really beautiful and gifted teachers that encouraged me. One of them encouraged me to write.
Wow. Well, I, for one, am glad they did, because otherwise we wouldn't have in front of us this very, very thought-provoking book called Deer Hunting with Jesus, Dispatches from America's Class War, published by Crown, and the author, Joe Bagent. Joe Bagent, I'm really glad we had this conversation today, and I hope we get to talk again sometime. And best wishes to you and to all the citizens of your hometown of Winchester, Virginia.
Well, thank you. That's very kind. I really appreciate it.
You're listening to the Friday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. Again, our scheduled guest for today canceled, and so we are into the archives for a couple of very interesting interviews. I hope you enjoyed that conversation with author Joe Bagent. For part two, we're going to be talking a little bit about the world of Disney, and of course, that's a world that right now a lot of us are not able to visit as we perhaps once were because of the restrictions of the COVID-19 pandemic. But we'll see what 2021 brings. In the meantime, from 2 years ago, an interesting conversation about a very new book about the wonderful worlds of Disney. And in this portion of the Friday Morning Show, I am delighted to be speaking with a Disney fan and journalist by the name of Bruce Steele, who has helped put together a marvelous new book called One Day at Disney, Meet the People Who Make the Magic Across the Globe. This is a book in which we in a sense, experience Disney all around the globe through the course of essentially a single day. And we're going to be talking with Bruce Steele for the next few minutes about what it took to assemble all of this wonderful information, all of these marvelous photographs, and what people are going to experience themselves if they take this book in hand. Again, the book is titled One Day at Disney, Meet the People Who Make the Magic Across the Globe. Bruce Steele, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thanks for having me. Good to be here.
So tell us, first of all, a little bit about what is behind those words, Disney fan. What has been your relationship to the world of Disney over the years?
Well, I mean, I grew up as a Disney fan, watching all the Disney movies. I remember being so happy when I'm old enough to remember when VHS tapes first came out, and then you could get your favorite Disney movies and watch them over and over again. And then in the 1990s, my husband was actually a Disney animator. So we had that magic silver pass that lets you go down to the theme park anytime you want and take guests. We lived in Los Angeles, and so we could go down to Disneyland and Anaheim as many times as we wanted. So I can't tell you how many times I've been there.
I wonder what particular projects your husband worked on. I mean, would these be things that we have seen, or was he an animator in a sense in more behind-the-scenes fashion?
No, he worked for 4 years on a Disney animation feature called Dinosaur that came out in the year 2000.
Very good. You know, your account reminds me of very close family members that I have who are at Disney all the time. I mean, repeatedly, year after year after year, they absolutely love it. And they aren't growing tired of it. And I think some people from the outside looking in would imagine that at some point the spell begins to wear off. And yet, at least for some people, that really does not seem to be the case. And it doesn't sound like it's at all the case with you. Explain kind of the lasting power that the Disney experience has on a lot of people. And I think that's a good segue into this beautiful book.
Well, I would compare it to, in Peter Pan, when they leave London and go to Neverland, and it's just, you know, this beautiful, idyllic place with some pirates, but it's a place that you can just revisit and sort of leave the world behind and enter a world that's perfectly made and perfectly displayed and fully entertaining and colorful, and then it's both always the same and yet always different.
I guess that's the part that sometimes people who are really not Disney people, so to speak, maybe don't kind of appreciate, or that sense of sameness is all that they maybe understand or all that they notice. And maybe not fully appreciating all of the ways in which Disney perpetually remakes itself, reshapes itself over the years. And I'm sure as someone who's been such a frequent visitor to various theme parks, you've seen that up close.
Well, yeah, and to tie it to the book, we talked to about a dozen different people in the Imagineering department. And the Imagineering division of Disney are the people who think up everything that goes into the theme parks. From the decorations that you see on the street to the very elaborate rides that they come up with that everybody loves. And they are, you know, they're constantly at work and constantly creating new things. One of the things that's a big part of the book is the creation of Galaxy's Edge, the new immersive Star Wars land that's at Disneyland and Walt Disney World. So, yeah, they're at work all the time creating new experiences.
Not sitting on their laurels at all. So let's talk more specifically about this book and what an ambitious project it was. First of all, whose idea was it, this idea of following, in a sense, the worldwide world of Disney through the course of a single day? Whose idea or concept was that?
Well, it actually goes to Bob Iger, who was the CEO of the company. I mean, as part of his job as CEO, he goes all over the world and meets all of these people who work for Disney in all these different capacities. And he thought it would be really interesting to show people who love Disney all of the different jobs that go into the creation of, well, what we call the magic of Disney.
And, of course, not just, for instance, Disney World, which is maybe what most Americans know
most intimately, but Disney as it is experienced across the globe. So, for instance, when we open up the book, where are we first?
Well, the first stop is actually Walt Disney World with a young woman named Stephanie Carroll, who is a ranch hand. But one of the interesting things about the jobs in this book is Disney takes ordinary jobs like ranch hand and makes them sort of magical and wonderful. And although her main job is to take care of the horses and to guide people on trail rides, she also gets to dress up in the magical coachman outfit from Cinderella and drive the Cinderella coach with a team of 6 white horses that are used for what they call fairy tale weddings. You can hire out the Cinderella coach as part of your wedding for wedding photos and for a wedding experience. And also the Cinderella coach, of course, appears in the parades at Walt Disney World. So not only is Stephanie Carroll taking care of horses, which she's been doing since she was 8 years old, she also gets to be a character in this story.
Hmm. And so Disney takes care to make sure that people that might even have what at a glance would seem like a rather mundane sort of position or responsibility, they see to it that even those kind of jobs have a little bit of magic sprinkled into them, so to speak.
Well, sure. I mean, take, for example, the security guard there's 2 security guards in the book. One of them is at the Disney Studios, and of course, you would think security guard would be a sort of a boring job, but he's the guy who, you know, gets to talk to Chris Pratt and Keanu Reeves and all these people that come in and out of the Disney Studios. The other security guard is at Walt Disney World, a guy named Pete Dufour, who is another Army veteran. There's several in the book. And Pete gets to run what they call the flag retreat ceremony every day at 4:30 when they take the American flag down at the plaza at the end of Main Street USA and retire it for the day. And every day they pick out of the guests who are coming into the park, just randomly select somebody who is a veteran, a United States veteran, and have that veteran participate in the flag retreat ceremony. And they honor that veteran's service every day, a different veteran. So even these really jobs that you would think would be uninteresting have really interesting elements to them.
Lovely. We're speaking with Bruce C. Steele about the book that he helped put together titled One Day at Disney, Meet the People Who Make the Magic Across the Globe. I do want to make sure we spread our gaze on sort of an international level, but I do want to have you explain to our listeners how much of the United States we see in this book. I mean, a lot of people, of course, know all about Disney World, and a lot of people know about Disneyland, which came before it, that are sort of on each of the coasts. But you don't settle for just those 2 locations. Explain to our listeners some of the other places right here in the United States that you also take us to in this book.
Well, of course, Lucasfilm, that creates all the Star Wars movies and experiences, is located in the Bay Area, as is Pixar up around San Francisco. So we spend a lot of time in the San Francisco area. ESPN is headquartered in Bristol, Connecticut, so we also have to go to Bristol, Connecticut. Have to go to New York City to talk to Robin Roberts from Good Morning America and David Muir from ABC World News Tonight. And, of course, then we go to the theme parks in Orlando and Anaheim. Now, I'm probably leaving some out, but that's a good sample.
So that reminds us, of course, that Disney is not just the things that are emblazoned with those Mickey Mouse ears or whatever other logos we associate with Walt Disney himself and Disney itself, but also some of the properties that Disney owns and operates, and that's a considerable list.
It is a considerable list. It's Pixar and Lucasfilm and ESPN and ABC and Adventures by Disney and Broadway shows. There's a lot going on.
So take us beyond the borders of the United States, because, of course, that's part of what is really wonderful about this book. We don't even have time, of course, to go through the entire list, but tell us some of the places outside of the United States that your book takes us.
Well, of course, we have to go to the Shanghai Disneyland Resort and Hong Kong Disneyland and Disneyland in Tokyo. My favorite story about the Asian properties is it was very difficult for me to set up interviews with the folks in Asia because when they're going to bed, it's about the time we're getting up in the morning.
Right.
So I finally had to get up really early in the morning to talk to a woman who is a stage manager for the parades at Tokyo Disneyland. And I talked to her at 7 o'clock my time in Asheville, North Carolina. And about 15 minutes into the interview, there was some this noise on the line, like, and I couldn't figure out what it was. And they said, oh, the fireworks have just started here.
Ah.
So at 7:15 in the morning on the East Coast in Japan, they're wrapping up the day with the fireworks at Disneyland Tokyo. And I just thought that was an amazing example of the scope of Disney and how there's always something going on 24 hours a day somewhere in the world.
Right. One of the things that Disney fans will especially appreciate is that you take us behind some of those cast members only doors where a lot of the magic is actually created away from the public eye. What kind of access were you given, and what did you think about in terms of what would be most interesting to share with the public? And maybe some of those decisions weren't even entirely yours to make.
No, the cast members were indeed selected before I came on board the project. That was a process that took more than a year, and I came on for the last year of the project to do the interviews and the writing. My favorite behind the cast members visit for myself was I was in Walt Disney World, and I got to go to what is called the Holiday Services Warehouse. And it is exactly what it sounds like. It is a huge warehouse. It is bigger than any Costco you can imagine. And there is nothing in there except holiday decorations, 50-foot trees, tiny little trinkets, entire rows of nothing but Santa heads and reindeer and all this stuff. And then in the back of the warehouse is an area that looks like an auto service kind of facility, except instead of servicing autos, they're servicing holiday decorations. So in place of an automobile brought up on a lift, they've got garland hanging there in front of them, and they're fixing up the garland for the holidays. And these people work at this 365 days a year, and you wouldn't even think of it unless you're reading something like One Day at Disney.
Hmm. Sometimes when we examine things that kind of have an aura of magic about it, sometimes when we examine things more closely, the magic begins to dissipate a little bit. I get the sense from the way you're talking that this has not had that effect at all on you. If anything, you appreciate the magic of Disney even more deeply now.
I think figuring out how the magic works just makes it more magical, because there is all this work and energy and planning and scheming and testing. I can't tell you how many times they have to test out the rides that they put together for the theme parks before they even get to the part where they're building it. And then there's a magical leap in between the technology and the nuts and bolts and the actual experience that is just sort of inexplicable. And I think knowing everything that goes on before you get to the experience just makes that experience all the more fascinating.
Hmm. Bruce Steele, the book is One Day at Disney, Meet the People Who Make the Magic Across the Globe. Thank you so much. Best wishes.
Thank you.
This weekend on the podcast version of The Morning Show, I'll be sharing an interview that dates back more than 20 years with outstanding fiction writer Jane Hamilton. It's a memorable conversation we recorded when she came to our old WGTD studios. To hear that, you need to subscribe to the podcast version of The Morning Show. Be sure to look for The Morning Show with Greg Berg on Spotify, Google Podcast, or Apple Podcast. Next week, political science professor Jerry Mast from Carthage looks back on the extraordinary events of the last couple of days in Washington, D.C. On Tuesday, a look at memory with the author of Carved in Sand. On Wednesday, how the importance of physical objects that are a legacy of maybe a trauma we've experienced or a larger whole-scale trauma like the Holocaust. Disposing of our meds properly.